The Rebel Capitalist Show, episode 192.
Welcome to the podcast that helps you build wealth and thrive in a world of out-of-control central banks and big governments. This is the Rebel Capitalist Show.
Hey guys, welcome to this evening's special live stream. I've got my two good buddies in the house, the real estate experts themselves, Mr. Jason Hartman and Ken
Cheers.
Mapple.
Woo!
Cheers.
And we're drinking beer. This is happy hour.
That's right. I got a bunch of people coming over for the Conor McGregor fight tonight. I cannot wait. UFC 257. But Jason, this is your brainchild, getting us together to talk some real estate, some macro, and get everyone here on a live stream. So thank you very much for bringing us all together, buddy.
Hey, my pleasure. My pleasure. It was Ken's suggestion. He says, why don't we all get together for a beer? And I said, why don't we just make it a live stream? So here we are.
Yeah. Very cool.
It's great.
Yeah. You know. Okay. So Jason, what do you want to do, buddy? You got a couple charts. You want to go right to the questions? What do you feel like?
Yeah. Well, let's do, I'm not ready on my charts, but I got a housing supply chart you guys will totally want to comment on. So I definitely want to share that with you in the audience. And, you know, a couple other things. So let me get those prepped here.
So, Ken, what's your take on end of 2021? Are you still kind of thinking we might see some little downward pressure on residential?
Yeah, well, it depends on where. Obviously, we're seeing big bubbles in some areas, as you know, as a result of people moving out of the core. But, yeah, I think, you know, this is interesting. I think for the first time, we're going to see technology really change the way real estate, is going to end up. Obviously, before everybody, you think about it, we had it before, but everybody's still driving into town, going into these buildings, and now, you know, that's all just dispersed. Yeah. So it's creating little bubbles all over the place, but also some problems in others. And I know Jason and I have talked a lot about this. It's going to be interesting.
Yeah, what technology is really changing everything for sure.
Ken, what would you do right now if you were just the average Joe? You had a, let's say, $250,000, $300,000 house, and you were really worried about the economy. You felt as though the housing market in your area was kind of like a bubble. And what the hell do you do? But let's say, you know, you got a wife and kids and they don't want to move and your wife really doesn't want to rent. I mean, do you do like a 30-year fixed cash out refi and try to put that equity to work someplace else to limit your downside there? Or, I mean, what the hell do you do?
Yeah, it's a great question. I actually do think that, George, we've talked a lot about inflation. I can't wait to get into that discussion with you. But I think if you can fix, you know, other people's money or, you know, bank money at, you know, say sub 3,
yeah,
long term, you're going to be well below inflation, you know, coming up into the, so the Fed's basically going to pay off your mortgage for you. It's just going to erode that debt.
Yeah.
So I think so. Usually, I'm a little, I have a little different viewpoint on that, but with the amount of money that people, you know, that the Fed's throwing into the economy and still will, I can't see how we're not going to have inflation. So I've been telling people to, you know, ratchet up that debt a little bit more, scoop some of that low price dollars and have them as reserves, you know, just in case, you know, especially if, they don't exactly know, you know, what's going to be happening next year with their employer or their business. And, you know, there's millions of people dealing with that.
Yeah,
that's interesting you say that, Ken, because a lot of financial advisors have used this story known as the Tale of Two Brothers. If you just search that, don't Google it because they're evil, but just search it on a search engine, not a brand name search engine, DuckDuckGo maybe. And they use this thing called the Tale of Two Brothers. It talks about one that levered up and didn't have much equity in his home. And then the other who seemingly did the right thing and paid off his house. And then they both lost their job and the country went into a recession. And the guy with the leverage, counterintuitively, was so much better off because he had cash. You know, it was out of the property. He had the cash available to him. And the other guy thought he was doing the right thing by paying down the mortgage, having equity. And as soon as he lost his job, nobody would refi the house.
Right.
You know, so he couldn't get that equity out. It was trapped. And if he couldn't pay his tax bill or his HOA, or, you know, if he had a small mortgage balance, that high amount of equity in his property actually made him a target for a predatory lender in a foreclosure. Right.
Yeah. So,
yeah. It's counterintuitive.
Yeah. George, you know, the big boys, you know, the private money, the private equity groups and the institutional money, they're going to safe, you know, havens. And, you know, they're put, as you know, you know, they're loading up on cash reserves. And, you know, the individual should do the exact same thing. Just nobody knows what's really going to happen.
Yeah, it's tough because, you know, you think we're going into an inflationary environment, but it's like the smartest thing to do is hold cash, but then you're losing purchasing power if the price of goods and services goes up. It's just, it's this catch 22. I saw someone in the comments talk about Rickards, and he was on with Robert the other day.
Yeah, I just had him on last week. Yeah.
Kiyosaki. Yeah. And I know Rickards is talking about deflation, but I've listened to a lot of what Rickards is saying. Be very careful with that, because when Rickards is talking about deflation, I think he's talking about asset deflation. He's talking about bonds potentially going back down to maybe, you know, the 30-year getting under 1%, call it 50 basis points, something like that. I don't think he's talking about the prices of the groceries you buy going down in price. I don't think he's talking about your healthcare bill going down, your kids' college education going down. There's a big difference. Most people in the financial world, when they talk about deflation, they're really talking about asset prices. They aren't necessarily talking about the stuff that most people actually care about. So I always use the example of the 1970s, and we all know we had considerable price inflation there with consumer goods and services. But the stock market went down from 72 to 74 in nominal terms by 50%. So adjusted for inflation, a lot more than that. And that's an example of we like to paint inflation and deflation with this broad stroke. And it just doesn't work like that. The devil's in the details. And it's a very nuanced topic. And then you combine the FX market on top of that, and it makes it even more complex.
No question about it. But, you know, George, yes, cash is susceptible to bad things in an inflationary environment, for sure. It gets stronger and more valuable in a deflationary environment, as we all know. But, you know, maybe it's not have it in cash. It's just have it where it's liquid within a couple of days, right? Which is definitely not in the property. And that's why I just don't favor holding a lot of equity in properties. There's only a few times where I think that's good. Like if you just have cash to park, too much cash, you don't have time to invest it, which is a bad problem, but it's admittedly a problem a lot of people have. And you can stick that money in a state, in a property in a state that has really good homestead laws, you know, then it's pretty protected, right? So Texas and Florida come to mind there. Other states are reasonably desirable. California's terrible, of course. But you know, you can put it in the S&P, right? I mean, if there's inflation, your stocks are probably going to do okay, right?
Yeah, well, they might not, though. Going back to the 70s, I think if you just keep it simple, I think it might work out from the standpoint, like what I'm doing right now personally, and what we're talking about in my member forum, and what I've been talking about on my channel, is a lot to do with commodities and obviously gold. You guys have heard me say many times before, I set up my portfolio in like a 10-80-10 split. So you got 10% gold, 80% in things that pay you to own them, such as real estate or dividend paying stocks. And you've got 10% kind of speculative stuff. Well, as of right now in that 80%, I've got quite a few commodities that are paying me to own them. So I think commodities, if you're losing purchasing power on your cash, you're most likely going to be making money on those commodities.
Which commodities?
With me personally?
Yeah, well, like, yeah, or any recommendations. I mean, you don't have to tell your exact personal stuff if you don't want to, but.
Yeah, you know. We've been, in Rebel Capitalist Pro, we've been talking about uranium. Mm-hmm. We've been talking about nickel. We've been talking about gold. We've been talking about coal, metallurgic coal. And, you know, I bought a lot of those stocks back in March. And, yeah, everyone's talking about Tesla and whatnot. Some of those stocks that I know Chris, my buddy Chris McIntosh, bought for his hedge fund are some coal stocks. Coal, like the black, ugly stuff that everyone hates.
You would think under Biden that's not going to be so good, right?
Well, no, but see, you're looking at the demand side of the equation.
Yeah, okay.
So what I would say to that, my rebuttal is, okay, yes, there's going to be lower demand, but let's talk about supply.
Mm-hmm.
You know, is anybody going to put capital to work in building a new coal mine?
No.
You see, yeah. So you've got this argument where if supply goes down a lot faster because it's persona non grata
right. In
the investment community, then you still could have prices go up. But my point is, even if you've got a pile of cash, if you've also got some gold, if you also have some commodities that are paying you to own them, or maybe if you got some real estate where you find a motivated seller and you force some appreciation through a remodel or repurposing the property or doing what Ken does, where he improves the property and increases rents, then you've got, and like Jason, what you guys said, you got packaged commodities
right. That
are paying you to own them. And I would argue that the housing most likely would go up or down. I'm not going to say with inflation, but it would be more aligned where stocks, the S&P, I think you might have some problems there, unless you own those commodity producers. And I think that the commodities are pretty much the ultimate hedge against inflation. But you see how you got cash, you got gold, you got commodities, you got real estate. I don't think you're going to, you know, you might not get rich, but you're not going to go broke.
Right.
Cash position.
Yeah. Yeah. Hey, George, I got a chart for you on that. So this is softwood lumber prices. Ken, this doesn't surprise you one bit, does it?
On one project, that we're doing, our lumber bid was $1 million higher.
And $1 million higher on one apartment complex versus what's the total lumber budget? Like, give us compared to what?
It was about 25% higher.
Wow. Can you imagine? I mean, everybody listening, can you imagine what that does to home prices? And, you know, when those construction costs go up, and it's not just lumber, right, Ken?
Package commodities, buddy. Package commodities.
Yeah, there's a lot of things. We're also having spikes in PVC. And, you know, there's supply chain issues, as you know, is part of this. But it's interesting. I was talking to some friends of mine that were buying some of these low-priced homes up in Idaho. And the builder won't even allow it. Basically, you know, before they said, yeah, we'll you can buy this house and then we'll build it for you. Now they're saying, no, because these prices are going up, you know, so they can't manage that 7-8 month lag on a new home. You know, they said you could put a deposit on it, but we need to settle on the pricing later because of these exact issues.
Yeah, it's incredible what's happening. So let me just see if you guys agree with this on this chart, okay? So the way I read this chart, and we've got a client who's buying properties from us, and he is a lumber supplier. So, you know, he like brokers big lumber shipments to home builders, and he was on the podcast maybe a month and a half ago. But he keeps sending me his insider newsletter, which is called Random Lengths, which is about the lumber industry.
Right.
And what I see that happened here is just what Ken said. Here, we saw the supply chain problem with the, you know, the sort of the first really bad part of the pandemic, supply being hit. And George talks a lot on his show about supply demand shock, which is a really interesting concept. And then, you know, we saw the prices peak here, and then the supply started to come back online. But then, you know, there's so much construction demand, and that's kind of how I read this chart. I don't know if you guys will agree.
But what do you think? I mean, is that, I totally get the demand side of the equipment, like more demand. But could it be also that a lot of the lumber companies just went bust and that they're not coming back?
I don't know if any of them went bust. I know that some closed down.
So what I was told is that there were some issues getting lumber out of Canada.
Yeah.
And then also, British, yeah. I was also told, although I've heard the other side of this too, that they were saying those wildfires and all that stuff that we had kind of also contributed to part of this. Now that seems, maybe that's not entirely true, but for sure the issues between the countries there's an affordability problem we have right now, and there's a housing issue as a result of low supply. So this could continue to go up based on, you know, whatever happens over the next year to two.
Why aren't people building right now? I mean, the prices are going up. You know, we know the cure for high prices are high prices.
Yeah.
So why aren't the big guys like you out there buying quote unquote affordable housing making all the money? Or do you hate more people?
I bet his answer is he wants to buy every piece of land he can find. But
I'm trying, you know, man. I'll tell you what.
It's so competitive.
We're making at least one or two offers a week on land. And it is jumping off the charts right now. Yeah. And the other thing that's happening is we're seeing, there's the lenders, they're being a little bit more frugal on the loan to values, and they have what's called COVID reserves now.
Oh, so what does that mean? You've got to have to build the project. You've got to have more money in reserve than you did before.
Yeah. So, you know, so they're lending less. So your loan to values would be less. So your equity would be more. The land prices are going up. The construction prices are going up. So, they're looking at all of that. And so they're being much more conservative.
How conservative, Ken? I mean, what happened to those loan to value ratios with the COVID reserves, or how much more do you have to put aside on a project?
In the 200 to 300 unit apartments, which is what we do.
Yeah. Folks, just so you know, Ken McElroy is the original god here. Okay. He builds big stuff. Okay. Big institutional grade stuff. Go ahead, Ken.
Yeah. So, George, we were talking about how, we're trying to get loans. We are getting loans, but they have this new line item called a COVID reserve. and a lot of the lenders, these lenders, they're not just doing single family. Of course, you have lenders are lenders. So they're taking it in the shorts on commercial office or self storage or retail and, some of the other things, even some multifamily and single family would be basically a piece of what they're lending. And so we're starting to see these COVID reserves on a deal that we just got priced this week. We had eight different pricings, and the COVID reserves were anywhere from 800,000 to 1.2 million in reserve. So that's extra cash that you got to give to the lender.
But Ken, like, what's the percentage of extra? How much? I mean, when you talk dollars, have a reference point.
Yeah. Okay. It's basically a year of mortgage payments.
Okay. So in other words, before you didn't have to have any, you had to have some mortgage reserves before, right?
It depended on the deal, but typically not. Typically they have a loan to value, and then they have a debt coverage ratio that when they look at your net operating income. But now they have another COVID reserve, basically a year of mortgage payments sitting aside. So essentially, you got to put $1 million with the lender. They hold it after a year of performance.
They'll let it go.
Release it. Yeah. And in some cases, it's stage releases.
Yeah. Wow. And so that's $1 million in this example. And how much did you have to put into that property total to do it?
That was a $50 million development deal, $20 okay. million of equity and $30 million of construction debt.
Okay, so it's $20 million in, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So it's an extra 1 million. So it's 21 million in versus 20.
You got
okay.
it. Exactly right.
That's not going to like kill your project though.
No. But it's, what I'm saying is that I guess it's, reserves are something that lenders do. And yeah. you know, we've bought broken properties before and we put up reserves before. So that's not unusual, but now it's called a COVID reserve and it's kind of across the board. So right. before it was case by case, now it's just a thing. And, yeah. At the moment, people are, they're uncertain, you know, what's going to happen when the Fed stops propping everything up.
Yeah. This is pending home sales. Okay. And I mean, look at how bullish the market is right now. It's absolutely en fuego, you know, like George on his show likes to say it's in the no bueno zone. Well, this is en fuego. It's on yeah. fire. Pending sales are up 32% from a year earlier. And you can just see the chart. I mean, it's, you know, 4-week rolling average of weekly pending home sales. If we had triple the inventory of properties, we would sell triple the number of properties. Yeah. There is literally like we almost never have a property that goes unsold now in our network. So we've got, you know, deals nationwide in different markets we like, and people buy everything. There's nothing is left.
What do you think? I was listening to Gunlock the other day and he was pointing out how the lower end of the economic totem pole in our society has been disproportionately affected by these lockdowns as far as jobs, because the main jobs that have been put out of commission are service jobs, like retail, food and whatnot. Yep. And that's generally the people who are just starting out or might not have a high income. But he was talking about how he sees potentially the job losses going from the bottom of the ladder up to middle management because of the new things that we're doing from home as far as Zoom and Skype and just this live stream as an example. And he was talking about his hedge fund or his firm that he's let go of several middle managers that were making, you know, solid six figures because now they're working at home. There's just no need. There's just a lot of overkill. And so he thinks that we've seen a wave of unemployment at the lower end, but next, especially when we continue these lockdowns, we could see a wave in the kind of the middle class or upper middle class jobs as well.
That's definitely a concern. But George, let me ask you, why is it just the fact that they're working remotely makes their job unnecessary?
Well, in Gunlock's case, he said he just found out how unnecessary all of these middle managers were.
Yeah.
It kind of just shed light on on the inefficiencies that he had within the organization that he just didn't realize. Now, obviously, that's an anecdotal case. But one thing that I would argue is I was reading a statistic the other day that 60% of the businesses that went into lockdown or got closed as a result of lockdowns are not coming back. And these are small businesses. And that's a big number. Oh, yeah. You've got 100, 200,000 small businesses across the United States closing.
Oh,
That's just going to affect the lower end of the totem pole. That's going to affect the middle class, upper middle class. When you consider the driver of our economy, especially with job growth, are those small and mid-sized businesses.
I agree. There's a lot of devastation we have not seen yet. The question is, where does the devastation go? Why don't you put our turn off my screen share, George, so you can make our pictures better? I don't want
to. I'll just comment on what George said. George, I've talked to a number of guys that there's a couple things that have happened. One is revenues are down. You know, let's just face it, for most people, revenues are down. So as we got pushed out to, telework and all that, you naturally start to look for ways to cut or save on expenses when revenues are down. And so that was one thing that I kept hearing reoccurring over and over and over and over. The other one was, if you've got a hierarchy of, let's say, five deep, you don't need that anymore with Zoom.
Right.
you know,
more efficient.
So people are home. And so like we did a Zoom, we did a state of the company address. You know, we had 100 people on and, you know, we were all on Zoom. And so the communication and all that stuff is so much better. And the technology's there. Before it was all kind of room to room, you know, meeting to meeting and conference to conference.
Right. So what people are seeing, Ken, is that, you know, the businesses are getting the benefit of this increased efficiency. And I mean, can you imagine the corporate travel budgets that have just gone from, you know, super expensive to fly these people around and the meals and the wining and dining? It's like zero. They're saving so much money. So in a lot of ways, I mean, it's good. Those efficiencies will benefit the economy, you know, right?
There's just so many moving parts. I'd be a lot less worried about that if the government wasn't stepping in and the Fed wasn't stepping in and distorting the economy, because then we would have creative destruction, you know, Schumpeter creative destruction, and the free market would determine which businesses survive, which don't, and which get stronger. My concern, and obviously I'm not considering the human element, which is even more important, but just looking at it from the standpoint of the businesses, my concern is that the central planners come in and distort the economy so much that now the winners and losers have nothing to do with free market economics or free market capitalism. And then you get an economy in the future that's far less stable than it was before. And let's remember that before we had 0% interest rates, the Fed doing quantitative easing, the Fed's balance sheet at $4.5 trillion, meaning that before the economy was incredibly unstable. Yeah. Now it's going to be even more unstable in the future. It's like, man, I just, you know, you hear Yellen, Janet Yellen, and you hear all these central bankers, and I hear a lot of smart hedge fund guys talk about it too. They talk about the downside to all this money print or all the government spending as though it's just the balance sheet. It's just the liabilities of the federal government. Like that's the only downside. It's just the debt. They don't talk about the downside being the in order for the government to achieve that debt, in order for the government to have $27 trillion in debt or to have $5 trillion in deficit spending just this year, that means there's $27 trillion of economic distortion. It's $27 trillion of malinvestment, of misallocation of resources. And they never look at that side of the equation. They look at government spending as, like I said, as if the only downside is the debt itself and not the government spending it in the first place.
Right. The other thing I heard the other day is, you know, you're going to start to see these lawsuits, obviously, you know, around COVID. I mean, invariably, that's going to be a thing. And just like you're going to see on the personal injury side, you're going to see that. There's almost none medically at the moment. Very, very small. And what you know what they are? They're all around the furlough piece. Because what happened was, you know, that first round of stimulus, I had a number of friends. When that went out and people needed it, don't get me wrong, but the employees sitting at home for $20 an hour and they're making choices to not go back. And so businesses during that time, you know, had to do what they had to do to open up or hire people. And so a lot of positions got replaced. And so that's what I'm concerned about with this next round is, It very well, it's going to help people and it's certainly they do need it, but what it could do is it could keep everything stagnant again.
Yeah. And see, that's an economic distortion, Ken, you're talking about.
Yeah.
Perfect example of that. You know, Ken, I know whenever I talk to people, especially about real estate, they just automatically assume commercial real estate or maybe retail. I don't know how you guys would classify it. Is just done. It's never coming back. You might as well short it. It doesn't matter how cheap it is right now. It's you just short it and continue to short it because it's not going to exist in 5 years, 10 years. And I know you know, Hartman is really focused on the residential side of the equation.
Yeah.
You get into multifamily, commercial, retail. What's, from a professional standpoint, do you see any opportunity moving forward?
There's a ton. I would encourage people to go to this, which is this is the Price Waterhouse report that just came out.
Okay.
And what it does is it shows by category. So commercial is obviously industrial, retail, office, but even then it could be class A office, class B, you know, class C. Same thing with industrial, it'd be small or big, and you know, so it's very, very, very different. The winners by a long shot are industrial. So the last mile distribution stuff with the direct to consumer, you know, Amazon, think of Amazon, that's industrial space. You might have 50 or 100 people working in one of those big buildings. It's full of stuff, right? Those are, you know, the data centers, cell towers, manufactured housing doing very well. Apartments are doing pretty well. We are seeing downsizing in office for sure. Retail's definitely in trouble, but not all retail. You know, if it has a grocery store anchor, it seems to be doing okay.
Or like an auto parts store, dry cleaners.
Yeah, Home Depot, Lowe's, you know, the home improvement stuff, all killing it, doing great. So, you know, when you can't really lump commercial into one big category, but there's some, there's some really, really, really robust commercial sectors, specifically industrial, that's killing it. An area I think that is a big opportunity for in the next 10 years is going to be the redevelopment of the regional malls. And
what's the new use though, Ken? It's hard for me to see that being very economical, you know?
Yeah, they're just
a dinner today. He's got a great game plan here.
Yeah, yeah. So I think, first of all, corporate headquarters and Amazon are looking at them for distribution. If you think about it. You know,
Amazon's doing the Sears, right? They're taking over the Sears spaces.
Yeah. So we've watched Sears, Macy's, Kmart, all that stuff kind of go down. And, you know, we've watched this already with some of those big, you know, names that were, are dwindling out now. But, there's been a number of like Kmarts that have been ripped down, and they have these kind of open air concepts with retail, residential above retail, as an example, smaller retail, with the residential above it, and you know, some other concepts around that, so I think, you know, the home builders too are going to snap up some of those for sure. They're expensive right now, obviously, but over time they may not be.
Yeah. So Jason, I want to take back just for a moment to kind of something that's applicable to the average everyday real estate investor. And I you know, if you could briefly describe just like a 30-second elevator pitch on what you do, and then I would love it if you could tell me what you're seeing as far as your local market specialists. Sure. And if they're able to source any deals right now, because people always ask me from a real estate investing standpoint, you know, well, if the market's in a bubble, is it still a good time to buy? And I'm like, well, you got to be real, real careful. You got to be cognizant of the fact that most prices are too high. But since real estate is inefficient, you can find a motivated seller, if you can find some good cash flow and use that 30-year fixed rate debt, you could. There is an argument for that. But how are they sourcing deals? Are they like bandit signs? Or what is working right now?
Yeah. You know, that's really interesting. So to answer your first question, George, you know, basically what I've been doing for the last 17 years, I had a traditional real estate company. Coldwell Banker bought it. It was in Southern California, in Orange County, California. And after that, I started helping investors buy properties nationwide. And what I would do is I would set up deals with what we call, like you said, local market specialists. And we would sign a referral agreement with them, and then we would refer buyers to them. And interestingly, back in 2003, 2004, 2009, really, we were doing 100% new homes from builders, big home builders. And in fact, back in like 2006, maybe it was, my team was the number one home seller in the country for the biggest home builder in the country then, D.R. Horton. We sold so many of their properties to investors. I just couldn't believe it. Right. And then I remember, I think it was in 2008 or nine, you know, during the Great Recession, we had this meeting in our office. We had an office back in Costa Mesa back then, Costa Mesa, California. And we had this meeting, and it sounds so funny looking back on it, but we're having this like big discussion. Do you think we should sell resale properties? Do you think we should sell used properties? You know, that like people rehab and fix up. I don't know about that. You know, we just really like these new homes. And it was like such a big deal that we had that conversation looking back on it, because, you know, the home builders just stopped, you know, as soon as they got rid of like any existing inventory they had, that machine just came to a halt. Hey, wait, George, hang on. We need sound effects here. It just came to a halt. It went like, you know, no more. and so then the market changed, and from, you know, from like 2009 on up to, you know, really just kind of, we still do it, but recently, you know, maybe 2 years ago, we were really focusing on rehab properties that were, you know, fix and flips. And these home flippers would flip them to our investors who would keep them as long-term cash flow holds, right? To just hold for, you know, the long term, and as rental properties. But now it's interesting. We're doing a lot more new construction again, and I guess it's because the flippers, they just can't source deals and make them work and get the appraisals to come in. So we're selling a lot of new properties now in Florida, Alabama, Tennessee, you know, different markets.
I wonder if that's because the local market special selling fast. That, because the advantage to sell through you, correct me if I'm wrong, is just instant liquidity.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. That would be that would be the upside to working with you. But maybe if they can just get instant liquidity by just selling it themselves, because the market,
they can stick them on the retail market, and that's true. You know, they don't, sadly, I hate to say this, they don't need us as much as they used to. So, you know, that's a bummer for us. But yeah, no, you're right. I mean, there's no question they can get liquidity, but see, on the individual fix and flip deals, they've got to have a foreclosure market. You know, well, I mean, it's not all foreclosures. They'll buy properties that are short sales. They'll buy them right off the MLS. They'll buy foreclosures. And so they don't have that. So all of the inventory being created right now is really being built.
Yeah.
And do you have thoughts on that, by the way?
Yeah. Just, one of the things that I've been seeing is as people exit this market, you know, let's say they sell a home, and do you feel like they're maybe not re-entering it because they feel like it might already be at a peak?
In other words, owner occupant?
Yeah.
No, I don't work in the owner occupant market directly anymore like I used to. But I think that, you know, assuming, like we've talked about so many times, Ken, assuming those properties are in a suburban market, right? That doesn't have civil unrest and it doesn't have, you know, contagion concerns, and it's not shut down, right? If it's in Phoenix, if it's in a Florida market or whatever, right? Those are good markets. I think people want to hang on to their homes. I think they're just kind of keeping them, and that's
There's a lot of varying opinions as to why supply is low. You know, it's the lowest it's been on record ever.
Yeah.
And, you know, which is why I believe the prices are, you know, obviously driving up so much. It's just, there's, I saw a statistic the other day. There was like one house per six realtors or something.
Yeah.
some crazy number. And so, you know, what are you seeing on the supply side? Obviously we've got the demand.
Yeah. Supply is definitely low. There's no question about it. I mean, that's the theme of everything. You know, it's been low for years. I mean, we've been complaining about inventory for, you know, at least 5 years now. Okay. But it's really, really tight now. So it's worse than before.
Think, Do you guys think that's a fun, by the way, I see a lot of people going back and forth in the comments. I just want to tell a quick story here before I ask that question. And I'm sure I'll forget the question. So the question is, do you think that the inventory is low because of the amount of inventory that's owned by hedge funds and private equity funds? Because they're not going to sell until interest rates go back up, at least on the 10-year, or they can parlay that money into a higher interest rate asset that they're more familiar with. Then the store has.
My answer to that is no. I don't think that's significant. It's a small. I mean, it seems big because when you look at like Invitation Homes or American Homes for Rent, and they have these giant numbers of tens of thousands of houses that they own, but in the overall marketplace, that's nothing. You know, I mean, it's big. Yes, they're huge investors, no question. But compared to the size of the overall market, it's not that big a deal.
Yeah. So people are asking what I'm going back and forth about what I'm drinking in the comments here, I see. And so I wanted to tell that quick story that I just went to the store to buy alcohol. I like those White Claw things. And I was telling
Hartman, yeah. You're ghetto.
That's pretty ghetto. You know, what's funny is I came back. I've been in the United States so long. I didn't even know what these things were because they were invented out of the country. My buddy's like, hey, you should try one. They're kind of ghetto, but they're good. So I tried them.
They are good.
That's pretty good.
You're going to be drinking Mad Dog 2020.
Old English. I'm going to get a 40.
Or Schlitz malt liquor. You know?
Yeah.
That's the kind of stuff we used to drink in high school because we had no money. Oh, not that we were drinking in high school, but just saying.
Yeah, exactly. But what was funny is I was going through the cash register or the checkout counter there, and I've got, you know, your boxes of the White Claw stuff, and then I got
Crystal.
A bottle to go along with it.
George is a very versatile guy.
he can
hang in the hood or in the upper crust.
That's right, baby.
1%.
That's right. Ken, what do you think about the idea of a lot of the inventory being sucked up by private equity hedge funds? And if you agree with Hartman, why on earth is the inventory? I've been scratching my head on this for so long. Why is it just because these builders just hate poor people, like I said before, and they don't want to make any money by providing them housing?
I'm joking.
Yeah, you know, affordable housing's been a problem for a long, long time. And one of the things that's very interesting, actually, I was going to show your people on this call, is as you start to see this, like this chart here, this is a little chart. These are rent control yeah. laws and states with heavy regulation. So what we're seeing is, you know, you think about it, Oregon passed a statewide rent control law as an example. Well, big money's not going to go there because they're raising their taxes on the expense side, and two, they're limiting their income on the rent side. And so, you know, managed money is going to find its way to, you know, to markets that are a little more free. I'm not saying they don't have rent control issues or they don't have affordability issues, but what I'm saying is that the money's going to go to where it goes based on, and I think this is starting to be a lot bigger deal. Before, you know, everybody was kind of a free for all. Now I think you're going to specifically see money go to markets that are going to work a little more with the developers. And that might be with tax incentives to be able to build something, you know, or tax credits, let's say, or, you know, something like that. But that's necessary, George, because the construction costs, let's say, if I'm going to build in Arizona or Nevada or Texas, they're really very similar. The land might be different.
This podcast is brought to you by Rebel Capitalist Pro, the best online investing research. I have teamed up with Chris McIntosh and Lynn Alden, two of the best in the business, to create Rebel Capitalist Pro and give you the tools you need to build wealth and thrive in this crazy world of economic insanity. Rebel Capital's Pro is jam-packed with Chris and Lynn's incredible research. We have live stream Q&As where you can ask your questions directly to Chris, Lynn, and myself. And the best of all, there's an online member forum which allows you to network, learn, and explore ideas with like-minded individuals. What are you waiting for? Check out Rebel Capitalist Pro right now at georgegammon.com/pro. That's georgegammon.com/pro. Take action today and do something your future self will thank you for.
What's your cost per square foot to build new, minus the land?
Yeah, so we're building apartments for about $200 a foot, or you know, let's call it $200,000 per unit, brand new, and you know, that's significantly higher than, you know, what it was. And
how much has it gone up? And like, what was it when? Like, give us a reference.
I built a new build in 2013. Or so for like $120, $130 a square foot.
Yeah, it's gone up at least that much. Now, you know, it's been going up since, you know, call it 2015. So this is no surprise for us. The good thing is the, you know, the prices and the rents have been going up too. So we've still been able to do it. And then interest rates have been going down. So we've been able to borrow cheaper. And so that's what's kind of fueled this up to this point. But the affordability, George, is going to continue to be a problem. It's really difficult to build under those numbers without some city or state, you know, help. And, you know, it's definitely needed. Hopefully there'll be more programs like that.
But the main takeaway there, Ken, is in order for high prices to cure high prices from the standpoint of the builder, we're going to need to see cost per square foot at like $250, $270, something like that, to make sure there's enough margin for builders to make it worth their while.
Yeah. Yes, that's true. And, you know, they've had these programs in place before. But they're, again, you start getting into what's called impact fees. If you want to go build in a city, you know, to plug in their water, sewer and all that stuff and the property taxes and all that kind of stuff, you know, they do get in the way. What we've seen just in the last year, Microsoft did a $500 million housing fund. So they're building housing up in Seattle. We've seen Google do that already.
Yeah.
Amazon came out with a $2 billion housing fund to be able to help provide housing for their
right,
workers.
Right. So Ken, though, I mean, like, that's not good, though, is it? No. All that does is bump up the prices. All this new money goes into the market. They just make the price go up.
It's happening, though.
Yeah, I know it's happening, yeah.
And it's because of the affordability issue.
Right, but it's going to make affordability worse. That's the irony of the whole thing. And, right. And you know, it's interesting. You were mentioning, like, they've got this program and that program. Like, what they need is less programs. They need to loosen up the regulations to make it easier for developers to build some freaking houses, right?
You agree? Like him or not, but I'll tell you, one of the great things that Trump did was put those opportunity zones out there. Yeah. And the opportunity zones, who knows if they'll still be around under the new administration. But what that did is it took people could defer their capital gains into these opportunity zones. And that's the incentive that these developers needed, because now they can defer all their capital gains and be able to build, you know, housing and other things that might be needed in areas that, you know, also need it.
Yeah, that makes sense. All right, you guys want to take a few questions?
Sure, yeah, let's do it.
Sounds good.
All right.
But yeah, Ken, you know, with what you were saying, I know you and George have repeated this often, and I love this saying, money always goes where it's treated best.
Yeah, you know? That's right.
Money always goes where it's treated best.
Have you ever tried to build anything new in California?
No.
Because money isn't treated well there.
Yeah, good point. All right, let me go to the bottom, right? Oh, well, I think I might know the answer to this, but Ken, have you thought about looking into the Dubai real estate market?
No, actually, I was talking to Anthem Blanchard last week about that. He's in Dubai
right now.
It's
amazing you know Anthem, by the way. Yeah, that's so funny.
I just had him on my show. It's going to be coming out next week. But he's in Dubai, and I have not looked at it. Actually,
I don't know who he is. Is he looking?
He's a Bitcoin guy.
I need to introduce you to him. You'd really like him.
Yeah, a libertarian guy. Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, I started talking about real estate in Dubai, like, what, Jason, 9 months ago, a year ago, something like that?
Yeah, I think Dubai is way too expensive and speculative. Talk about a bubble market.
No, listen, you can buy right now in the Burj Khalifa under the cost of construction.
Wow. No way, really? I've been to the Burj Khalifa. I took my mastermind group to Dubai a couple years ago.
Yeah, cool. I mean, and that's their stated price. That's without even negotiating. And it's true that the RV ratios are garbage. But yeah. I want to go there just to see how much wiggle room there is on those prices.
I would think Dubai is a highly speculative type of market, you know.
But if you can buy under the cost of construction, if you can buy with a 1% RV ratio.
That's the key.
I mean, how speculative is that?
Well, you said the RV ratio didn't work, though.
No. At their asking price. But that's like the same as Medellin.
Well, if you can get a 1% RV ratio, and I don't know what the tax regime is like there or any, you know, property taxes or anything, but, and utility bills, you know, and they're just issues.
And also, too, I need to define that because the way you and I look at RV rates is a little different. I'm looking at cost basis where you're looking at just market price. So my point was, if you've got a 0.5 or 0.7 RV at market price, but you can go in there and negotiate down to where your cost basis, you're getting a 1%, you know, that's what I'm talking about.
Yeah. Yeah. Hey, if you can get a 1% RV ratio there, that sounds pretty interesting, but that's amazing to me. Now, the other thing you need to be cognizant of is the legal environment. So, and you know, I'm no expert on this. I don't know about Dubai that much, but I do remember reading an article saying that like they have a funny court system where non-Muslims don't get rights and things like that. So, you know, you just got to keep in mind, what if you have to, you know, evict somebody or collect rent or enforce legal contracts? You know, it's just something to know about. The U.S. is a very special market because it's got good rule of law and it's transparent. It's also, the U.S. has really good data. You know, you don't have Zillow in all these other countries. You don't have clear, easy closing processes and recorded deeds where you know the prices and the comps. Like, you know, everywhere I've looked at around the world, and I've looked at properties in many places, many countries, you know, they have these, they call them off-plan developments. And like, you never know what anything's worth in these places without being a complete local specialist, you know?
See, that's what I like.
I agree, because you were in Colombia and, you know, and in Ecuador, and you really lived there and knew the market, right?
Yeah, I knew it like the back of my hand. I had the data just from doing the boots on the ground research. So someone would come in and sell, even the Colombian, they'd own their property for 20 years. They'd go to sell. They'd have no clue what it was worth. Yeah. The only measuring stick they'd have is what they paid for it. And it went up significantly in nominal prices, but real prices, it doesn't go up much. So let's say it's worth, you know, they bought it for 50 grand. The going price is 200, but they don't know the going price.
So you pay them 51 and they're happy.
125 because they think that's a windfall. Yeah. And you go in there and pay 100 for it. They're happy. And you're buying a dollar for 50 cents. So the more inefficient the market is, the better. Sorry to cut you off there, Ken.
No. I was just going to say that I've had I've had many friends going to other countries, and then the countries have changed the rules. And in some cases, they had to walk from the real estate. So what Jason said is really important.
Yeah. Thanks, Ken. And, you know, speaking of changing the rules, you know, these stories in Dubai about how all these Lamborghinis and Ferraris were just abandoned on the side of the road because people were like rushing to get out at, you know, some certain time. I can't remember what that was all about, but, you know, so things can change. Like, the U.S. changes really slowly, which we complain about, but it's good in some ways.
I don't know if it changes that slowly.
Well, you know, the law doesn't change that quick here. I mean, really? Yeah. Well, Ken will tell you. I mean, Ken, you know, when you were teaching people about real estate 10, 15 years ago, is it really very different today? I mean, I could play one of my old podcasts from 15 years ago tomorrow, and everything pretty much still applies, except the prices are different.
And except for the fact that the government's locking everyone in their house and not allowing businesses.
Well, yeah. That's a black swan event. Okay.
about 2 days, and you go from the United States to Marshall.
Every 102 years, we're going to have a pandemic, George.
He said it. I didn't need it.
It's a pandemic.
Email.
COVID-1984.
Yeah. Okay, let's see. George, do you think about, what do I think about investing in real estate in Venezuela? I like it. I think I'm not saying just go in and just buy the first thing you see. Like to our point earlier, you have to be a local expert. If you're not a local expert, you're going to get your butt handed to you. You're going to lose a ton of money.
So you think Venezuela's hit bottom?
Well, I mean, it's not whether it's hit bottom or not, is it cheap or is it expensive? And so I don't know where I'd start is that island they have off of, there's a real, I forgot what it's called. Margarita Island, is it maybe? Something like that in Venezuela.
I like the Jimmy Buffett song.
Yeah, but I'd start looking at it. I mean, I wouldn't pull the trigger, but if you know the local market, if you know it like the back of your hand, if you're an expert, if you can take advantage of the market inefficiencies, I mean, I can't imagine it's cheap right now, but question. Okay, Ken, as an average Joe, I live in Southern California and I'm looking to purchase my first home for my family. And when would be the best time to purchase a home? What do you think on that? And then Hartman or Jason, I know you have specific numbers you look at to make it more quantifiable as to whether or not you should buy or rent in your local area. But Ken, what are your thoughts on that? That was addressed to you.
Sure. Well, I think that obviously there's a big net migration out of California overall, but not in every city. Because I think it's you first got to kind of take, I always tell people, you got to be careful not to catch a falling knife. Like, you know what I mean? So you got to let the knife fall. And so in a lot of areas, I still think it's falling. So I don't know what area specifically. Southern California is a big area. Obviously one of the things that's driving the prices up right now is low inventory in some of those areas, but you're also seeing, a lot more inventory in others. So, it's very market specific but I would bet that there's some deals over there, because if you just follow the numbers, people are leaving, and I think that's going to continue over the next year for sure.
Yeah, Jason, what do you think? I tell people to, even if you're buying a home as an owner occupant, just look at the RV ratio. If the RV ratio is below 5, if it's 1, buy. You know.
Yeah. So what George means by that is always, even if you're buying the house to live in, which you are in this case, always view it. At least consider it from an investor's point of view, right? And so if you look at, you know, what are you going to need to pay for that property? And then what is the fair market rent on that property? Then you have another way of sort of comping the property to know whether it's cheap or whether it's expensive, like George always says. So for example, if it's a $600,000 property in Southern California or wherever in the world, doesn't matter, the fair market rent on that property is $3,000 a month, that would be a 0.5 RV or rent to value ratio. And that would be pretty low. Okay. That would mean that to rent that would be a good deal, but to own it and rent it to somebody else would not be a very good deal because it's only a 0.5 rent to value ratio. Now, Ken, in your apartments, and you probably don't look at this or think of it this way, but maybe you do, you know, like, because you're looking at the whole huge deal, right? But if you had to take it down to just one unit, right? What's it cost to build one unit? Is that one apartment unit, say, $150,000, for example?
Yeah.
Okay. Exactly. And how much would that one unit rent for? $1,300?
Yeah, $1,300 to $1,500, depending on the unit type. Okay. That would be a one.
So you got 1% or close to 1% RV ratio on, you know, maybe an apartment complex with 200 units in it, right?
Right.
So that's good. So that home, if it's only renting for $3,000 per month, it's expensive. Okay. That's how you know. If you can buy that house for $600,000 and the fair market rent is $4,500 per month, you know, then you're looking at a 0.75 RV, right? And that's better. That's pretty good. You know, but buying a home is, you know, obviously an emotional decision. And you can't look at, you know, if you have the money, if you're not like scraping to do it, then, you know, the whole point of making money is to buy what you want, right? Not everything has to make sense anymore. You can do nonsensical things. As I've always said, invest in places that make sense so you can afford to live in places that don't make sense.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, that's a good point for sure.
And I've been to Ken McElroy's home, and believe me, it does not make sense.
Terrible RV ratio.
It's very nice, but it would not rent for anywhere near the value.
Well, look at the place I'm renting right now. Yeah. I mean, my goodness, this guy, I mean, I don't know if I've told you, Jason, but the place I'm renting, not only is it furnished,
yeah,
I don't even pay utilities.
Yeah.
All inclusive. Yeah. And it's, I would guess it's,
Is probably worth $700,000,
$800,000. More than that.
Oh, really? I haven't kept track of it. Yeah. Because yeah, I know the building you're in. You're in the building where John McCain used to have a place.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
That's a nice building.
This RV is garbage. Anyway, but it's great for me.
Yeah. No, it's better to be the tenant a lot of times. You know, the higher you go up on the price scale, the better it will almost always be to be a tenant than an owner. Okay. Yeah. And what you do, if you have cash, you take that cash and you buy a bunch of inexpensive properties that you rent to other people that have really favorable RV ratios for you, the investor, right? And then you're arbitraging both sides.
Yeah. So this question is for me, but Ken, I think it's probably better for you. I might just punt this one. It says, George, what is a good price per acre on undeveloped land? And I don't play that. I don't really like the undeveloped land game. I think that's more, do you have any idea on that? Yeah, what would you say?
Yeah. So there's a few things. You know, usually land is more expensive in the city core, at least it used to be, you know. So you're going to find it could be 1 to 5 million an acre, like downtown, in a lot of downtowns. As you move out, it's going to be a lot less. And then, of course, it goes to farmland. So it just depends. The big issue is always around zoning. So every apartment deal we do is based on contingent zoning. So we never buy 15 or 20 acres without knowing that we're going to be able to put 200 or 300 or 400 unit apartment community on it. So we'll have it in escrow a long period of time. We might pay, say, $8 to $10 a foot for something like that. So my range right now on stuff that we're looking for in Phoenix is $8 to $10 a foot. And the land is $43,560, I think. Square foot per acre. So you can kind of back into the math. So call it, you know, 350 to 450,000 an acre. But obviously it depends on what you want to do on it. You know, I have a good friend that, George, he does farmland. He kills it. He goes and buys his farmland and then, and leases it to, you know, these guys that want to, you know, farm on it. So
yeah.
It's great. So there's a lot of things you can do with land.
You know, I got a lot of buddies that do that in Kansas City. And I have other buddies that do the same thing. And they actually get a great return by renting their land out to deer hunters.
Yep.
And I didn't even know that was a thing.
Yep, they do in Texas.
When people hunt deer, they like track them for like 2 years. And wow. I had no clue, but yeah, so they want the same piece of land for like 2 years and actually will pay rent so they can go track the deer on that land and they get a decent return.
Wow. Well, but you guys, you know, we've looked into farmland many, many times over the years, and we have a client who finances farmland, and he's buying residential properties through us. And we have looked and looked, and we've talked to farmland brokers, and it seems like they're just never good yields on those properties. You know, they're really low cap rates. And well, now Bill Gates is in the market buying up everything, but I think that's for a more conspiratorial reason. we can go there if you want.
I mean, Klaus setting up a private equity firm to buy all
Well, he's going to genetically engineer our food and make our genes infertile and make us go extinct because he wants to lower the population. But Ken, are you agreeing or not? Or are you looking the other way like, shut up.
I had a guy on my podcast that he does chickpeas or hummus, you know. He does a million bags a month. Wow. So think of a million 100-pound bags a month. So he's got massive farmland. And, you know, he knows, as long as you know your number, he knows what he can yield. He knows what he can pay. And he's been growing like crazy and buying land like crazy as he expands, you know, because hummus is really obviously grown. And now they're going to do all this stuff. You should check it out. They've got like hummus milk, you know, because it doesn't have any, you know, it's really good for you. And you know, all these other things. So there's all this stuff coming out that he's on the front side of by doing farming.
So here's a question for both of you that I'd be curious to get your thoughts on. How will moratoriums affect the market once people have to start making their rents again? Will mass foreclosures take place? Can the Fed let that happen?
Ken, you know, Ken, you got a lot to say about that.
I do, So we're right around, you know, the number I've heard 15 million. I've heard, you know, over 20 on the eviction side. So that's kicked out to March. And then on the forbearance side, you know, we have a couple million people that are seriously delinquent. And, you know, the good news, if there is any, is some of those houses have gone up in price. So if you really look at the numbers, they actually have made it up in equity. They just haven't been able to make the payment. So, but they're not really financeable, would be my guess. So I do think we're going to see a lot of inventory hit the market next year. I don't see how I don't know if you guys saw California, I think passed a law or has tried to pass a law that they get first right of refusal on foreclosures. Did you see that?
I saw that. That's
California.
The state?
Yeah.
California is moving into absolute communism. I mean, the government is playing way too big a role. They are totally overstepping their bounds. But
that's great reset stuff. That's 23. You'll own nothing and you'll be happy.
Remember? If that happens, then it'll be a really soft landing for all.
But what they're doing, you know, their excuse for that, Ken, is that they're saying, well, we want to preserve the opportunity for first-time buyers or disadvantaged people. Now, of course, they'll have their politically correct definition of who's disadvantaged.
Right.
And it definitely won't be, you know, anybody with certain skin colors, right? Like white is what I mean. My group will be discriminated against for sure. That's what will happen. And,
you know, I was talking about I won't go into it on this video too much, but how I think the definition of domestic terrorists is just being expanded.
If you're a Republican, you're a terrorist now. Yeah.
Apparently. Yeah, exactly. and the people on the other side said, well, that's because they deserve it. But I always say, that's fine. Be very careful with that, because the same power that you give the government to shut down Trump supporters is the exact same power that you're giving them that would allow them to shut down a group that you may be in favor of, such as Black Lives Matter or Antifa or anything like that. So the
that requires too much foresight, George. The people that are doing that, they don't have that kind of foresight. They're just happy, you know, their guy won, and they just want to get vengeance on the losing people instead of just celebrating, like, hey, we won. Let's, you know, we're in power now. Let's celebrate. You know, they're just being vindictive. It's crazy.
Yeah, it's scary. Just goes back to tribalism,
But my point of the California thing, though, was that, you know, the government, whenever they do something, they always claim it's like for a cause, it's for our own good, it's for our own protection, you know, and this one, they're using the excuse of the first time buyers, right? And, you know, we've all seen how disastrous rent control is, for example. And all rent control ultimately does is it just leads to housing shortages.
Right.
I mean, show me a place that's had a long history of rent control that has an abundant housing supply.
Yeah, like rent control fixed the problem.
Yeah, yes. Rent control made the problem. I mean, you know, it's just a disaster.
Yeah, so here's a question, and I get this frequently from the Canadian folks, or maybe the Australian folks. And Jason, you've probably thought about this. Ken, I don't know if you've given this much thought, but bottom line is Canadian real estate, specifically urban areas, have had massive year-to-year price gains. What is the best move for young well earners hesitant to buy a primary residence and hold, look for cash flow elsewhere, ? And Jason, I know you actually work with a lot of Canadian investors that are looking into the United States for maybe a little bit better opportunity, less downside, because we know that Canadian market is in just a huge bubble along with Australia. Ken, do you have any thoughts on the Canadian market?
Yeah, I've been up there a lot, and you know, it goes through cycles just like the U.S. market. But the thing about when a market gets hot, there's plenty of places to find cash flow deals. It's just not, might not be in your particular submarket. And so that's pretty normal. That's why, what we'd like to do is we like to invest in multiple markets, because like right now, Austin is hotter than hot in the United States. But 10 years ago, it wasn't. And, you know, and you got other areas that are hot and are not. And so, you know, I think that's just part of real estate investing. And, you know, markets get hot and they get trendy and then they, you know, then they don't. So, you know, it's just the wrong time in the cycle, it sounds like. But investing in Canada is not any different it is a little bit different on the mortgage side, but it's really not that much different.
Yeah, right. You don't get the great mortgages like you do in the U.S., though.
Right.
And I mean, you didn't say it, Ken, but well, I mean, do you think the Canadian major cities they're just overvalued, if you ask me.
Without a doubt. I grew up in Seattle. We used to go up to Vancouver all the time. I go there still all the time. It's just crazy, crazy high. I think one thing that is interesting, George, is I made a bunch of money for my Canadian investors when they came into the market in mid-2000 because it was a Canadian dollar. The U.S. dollar and the Canadian dollar was kind of par at the time.
All right.
And now it's dropped. And so not only did they make money in U.S. real estate, but then they made money
on the exchange.
Yeah, on the exchange. And it was like 30 to 40%, depending on when we exited, on just the exchange. And so that's something I think that people can lose sight of, you know, between the countries. There's a lot you can do just by watching the dollar, and you can use that arbitrage as well.
Yeah, and I'd argue the dollar.
Australian investors have definitely taken advantage of that when applicable to. Yeah.
Yeah, Jason, you know, can you expand on that just momentarily? Because as American investors, or as Americans, period, I think 99% of people assume that 30-year fixed rate mortgages are just everywhere. It's just the free market creating a mortgage. And they don't understand that that is not a product of the free market, because banks are almost guaranteed to lose money, which means the borrower is almost guaranteed to make money because of the purchasing power difference and paying it back with cheaper dollars. But no bank would do that in the real world because they know they're going to lose money. Can you kind of expand on that, how our market is subsidized and opportunity, especially consumer price inflation?
So after the Great Depression of the 30s, you know, the government, in its infinite wisdom, sponsored an entity, and they called it Fannie Mae. And the stated mission of Fannie Mae was to expand access to home ownership, which I believe is still its stated mission. And so what it did is it started offering these extremely desirable mortgages, and these 30-year fixed rate mortgages now, especially, but even in the past, have been these huge wealth creators for people. And it only applies to 1 to 4 units, which is considered residential. When you go 5 units or more, you're in Ken's domain, which is, you know, commercial properties. Now you could go 500 units, but just 5 or more is considered commercial. So, and there are Fannie Mae plays in that area too, but not in the same way. Okay. And so these fantastic 30-year fixed rate mortgages are right now literally at negative interest rates. So when you subtract real inflation, which George and Ken will both tell you is much higher than the stated inflation rate that the government would like us to believe of, you know, 1 to 2 to 2.5%, which is, you know, what the government will tell you in and out. And they manipulate that in 3 ways: through weighting, hedonics, and substitution. So they understate the inflation rate intentionally. So you're borrowing at this incredibly low rate, the interest is tax deductible, and inflation devalues that interest rate too. So you're literally getting paid to borrow, even if the property is vacant and produces no income. But what if it does produce income? Then it is phenomenal. It is like the most incredible thing. Not only are you getting paid to borrow the money, but then you stick a renter in there and you tell them, pay the mortgage plus, on a single family home, pay me $200 extra per month, and then give me all these tax benefits because it's the most tax favored asset class in America. Yeah. And that's why it is the best investment ever. And I have a sound effect for that.
you're basically getting paid to short the dollar. And Ken and I were actually talking to Kiyosaki about this the other day, how it's almost like the property, if you look at someone's balance sheet, the property has become the liability and the debt has become the asset. And it's just it's a bizarre world we live in. But
The debt is a huge asset. So you don't want to pay these properties off. You want to keep these incredible 3-decade-long fixed rate mortgages. Think about it, folks. It's 2021. If you get a 30-year fixed rate mortgage today, right, you won't be required to make the last payment on that until 2051.
Yeah, what's the dollar going to be worth then?
It's going to be worth nothing. We may not even have a dollar then. Okay. I mean, it's going to be so debased through inflation. And I'll just give you an example. People that borrowed a 30-year fixed rate mortgage in 1972, by the time, and you know, a dollar was worth a dollar in 1972, right? That was a year after we went off the gold standard. Right. But by 2001, when they made the last payment on that mortgage, that dollar was only worth 24 cents. So everybody that bought the median price single family home in 1972, the millions of people that did that, okay, and got a 30-year fixed rate mortgage at the time, 7.37%. By the time that 30 years ended, they not only lived in that home for free, they actually got paid to live there. They got paid 1.16% after inflation and tax benefits to live in the house. They got paid to live there.
Yeah. And, I mean, you've said so many times that if you could just get the 30-year fixed rate mortgage without the property, you'd take it.
Yeah. I'd take it all day long. But I do like the income from the property.
I was doing some research after we talked last, George, and you know, after the U.S. was in the war in the 40s, we had massive debt, you know, not like today, but we had a lot as compared to that period of time. And what the Fed did is they relaxed inflation and it went up. I think the average was 4.5, you know, somewhere in there. And in that 10-year period, they lowered the public debt by 40% by letting the inflation go. And yeah, so that's what I think is going to happen. I think, you know, all this debt's going to stack up and then they're going to let that inflation line out and it's going to go down. The problem is that these people that are on fixed incomes like Social Security,
it's terrible.
They're going to get really hurt. It's going to be horrible in that area. But that's what I think is going to happen next.
Yeah, that's the best business plan is to pay off your debt through inflation. And so what I always say is as investors, we want to align our interest with the two most powerful forces the world has ever known, governments and central banks. Yeah. And governments like to spend too much money and central banks, you know, make the whole thing possible. And yeah, so they're going to inflate their way out of the debt. It's the only thing they can do.
Yeah. Okay. So guys, we'll probably wrap things up here. Let's do another question I got, and it's right in Ken's wheelhouse, although this is kind of residential, but they're right here in Arizona, Ken, which is why I wanted to touch on this one. It says, Ken, any pointers on buying land and a new build in Fountain Hills? First time home buyer. About 500 in cash available.
He knows Fountain Hills.
Yeah, I do. You know, the thing is you got to know that you're going to spend at least $200 to $300 a foot to build a house and plus the land. And so then right now those numbers are making sense. And, you know, we're seeing in Fountain Hills specifically, there's a bunch of specs all over the place. And so obviously the variables are, you know, interest rates, you know, they won't fix them during a construction loan and the components that we started talking off about earlier, you know, lumber and all the other pieces. And I also think that we might see some subcontractors not make it, you know, through this period of time. And that is actually also going to be another negative, and it could potentially drive some prices up.
Yeah. Okay. So I just want to address this one thing here before we say our goodbyes and get off to the fight. And I'm going to get off to my bottle of Cristal here. But, you know, we've been talking about taking now the debt's good. And if you got some equity, you might want to refi at a 30-year fixed rate. This person is saying, but what do you do with the home equity? And I've heard a lot of people say, oh, yeah, that's a great idea, George. I'm going to go out and take all my home equity out and buy Bitcoin. Or I'm going to take out all my home equity and buy silver or buy gold. And, you know, I think Bitcoin is a great speculation. I think everyone should own gold for an insurance policy. But I want to be clear that when Ken and Jason and myself are talking about these things, we're not saying that just your average Joe go out there and do it. We're saying these could be good ideas on paper, but you got to know what you're doing. You got to have some degree of sophistication. You have to be willing to do the homework in order to do this well and have a mathematical edge on your side. But if you're thinking about doing this, the bottom line is. I would love to get your guys' opinion on this. If you're going to take out that equity, you got to buy something or put it to work in an asset that pays you enough to own it in order to make the mortgage payment. See, if you take that money out and now you've got a mortgage payment but don't have any cash flow to subsidize it, you've got a negative carry on that mortgage. It's not being put into a productive asset. I would argue that that's probably not a good game plan. But if you can take out that equity and buy a piece of real estate that's cheap, as an example, and where you're getting a good RV ratio, you got good positive cash flow to cover that mortgage payment, it could make sense. If you take that equity out, buy a good dividend paying stock now, let's say in a commodity space that's paying you 8 or 10% to own it. And therefore, you can take that dividend, pay the mortgage payment, and you still have a positive carry, and you're limiting your downside because you can only lose so much equity because you've pulled it out of the house at 80% loan to value. So what do you guys think about that?
Well, I tell you, I think Kiyosaki said it best. He's like, he wanted to go buy a Porsche. And Kim said, no. Don't buy the Porsche, buy a property that pays for the Porsche.
There
that's
you go.
What I'm talking about. Yeah. You know, so right. So take that equity, match it up with debt, and then use the cash flow, you know, for that kind of investing. Because now you're using other people's money. So that's the way to think. You know, whenever I want something, I use equity to try to figure out how to pay for it. I don't just buy it. You know, you don't want to buy depreciating assets.
Yeah. Yeah. And my thing is that especially depreciating that I have a negative carry. My goodness. Double whammy. Jason, yeah. What do you think?
Well, like Ken said, and Robert says, you know, it's a doodad, right? And if you want to buy a doodad, buy something first that's going to pay for the doodad.
Yeah.
You know, so.
Nothing wrong with doodads. Yeah. But use debt. That's the whole point of this talk is use debt, match it up with that equity.
Yeah,
I just get concerned if people take out that equity and use it for something that isn't going to pay them. All of a sudden, they've got a $500,000 mortgage they have to pay off because we told them to take out that equity, but they use the $500,000 to buy a piece of land, as an example, that's not paying them, or they use it to buy gold that isn't paying them. So they have to come out of pocket for that mortgage payment. That's my point. And that would be my
concern. George, you know, the show we did a long time ago when I was on your show, I don't know, like a year ago, we did a show about refi till you die. And we say, you know, take that money out and buy more properties with it. And Ken, he illustrates that as well. And you call it infinite, what do you call it?
Infinite. Yeah, infinite return. Infinite. Yep.
And he's got t-shirts for that too.
Yeah. That's right. Once you have your cash out, you know, then it's free.
Yeah.
All right.
So awesome. take the equity out, get control of it, but don't be irresponsible with it. You know, use that equity, you know, depending on how big a cushion you have. If you have a whole bunch of cushions everywhere, then go buy a boat, you know, fine. But that's, you know, not a good idea, but, you know, it is if you can afford it. But otherwise, you know, buy income property with it or, you know, dividend paying stocks or something that's going to pay.
Hey, Mark's here.
What?
Mark's here. Mark Moss.
Oh, hey, Mark.
Hey, Mark, what's going on, buddy?
He's on Thanks the chat. For
yeah, I think so. And hey. I guess he's joining from Puerto Rico. Very cool, Mark. Hope you're well, buddy. Thanks. In fact, Mark's probably watching the UFC fight tonight for sure. But
I talked to him today on Voxer.
Yeah.
All right. So let's do some shout outs here. We'll go to the end of the chat. Guys, thanks for hanging out. Gentlemen, we had almost 2,000 people.
Wow. Join us. That's awesome.
So, pretty cool. If you think about, you know, what we'd have to do to speak in front of a room of 2,000 people. That would be a lot harder back in the day than it is now.
These are our logistics. This is it.
Yeah. There you go. All right. Well, first and foremost, we've got our great buddy, Mark Moss in the house. We've got Eagle Deal Donkey on Twitter, Matt Linton, Ian Niculuso, I think, Freedom Stacker, Roddy Cardona Valderrama, RR. David Armstrong, Juggernaut, All Night Heater, Ian. I think I said Ian.
Danny, hey, George. Before you keep going, you got to ask everybody to smash the like button and leave a comment below and tell us where you're watching from.
Okay.
Go ahead. Well,
there you go. Jason did it for me. So. All right. Okay. And I think that's it, guys. I'm going to get off to UFC 257. You guys enjoy your evening. Thanks for hanging out with us. And we will, all three of us, will see you on the next video.
Thank you for listening to the Rebel Capitalist Show. For more content like this, check out the Rebel Capitalist blog at georgegammon.com or go to the George Gammon YouTube channel.